Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, there's been a rash of older people falling during the pandemic. But up front, critical race theory. Why has it become one of the hot-button debates over race in America? Critical race theory is a way of understanding how racism shapes and influences government institutions. The debate around critical race theory is currently focused on how or if it should be included or included in school curriculums. It is a complicated topic that is certainly more nuanced than people on either side of the argument probably appreciate. Joining us is Dr. Scott Hancock. He's a professor of history and Africana studies at Gettysburg College. Dr. Hancock, welcome to the program. Let's start with a definition. What is critical race theory?
Good morning. I define it as a body of thought that tries to understand the extent to which race and racism has shaped the United States, particularly in its institutions like legal, economic, governmental systems, and uses critical thinking, which in academia we say that's just rigorous analysis based on evidence, to kind of assess how race has shaped the United States over time into the present.
So, you know, the definition you just gave might not be clear to a lot of people. You know, one thing I've read is that the idea behind critical race theory is that it is a social construct, that racism is not merely the product of individual bias or prejudice, but also something embedded in legal systems and policies that relates to what you just said. Would you agree with that assessment?
I'd say that's a part of critical race, of this body of thinking that we call critical race theory. It's not what it's not the whole of it. It's because it sounds like, Scott, what you're talking about is the term that we hear a lot today, systemic racism or institutionalized racism. And yeah, certainly critical race theory would argue that race and racial thinking and racism has shaped systems in the United States over time and into today. And it's got a lot of evidence to back that up. And you also mentioned the term social construction. I would say that's actually another segment of critical race theory, which these are all linked, right? That critical race theory is the people, the thinkers, the scholars and activists who have said over the last 40 plus years that race is a social construction. So I think most people understand today that, you know, biologically, scientifically, there's not a lot of foundation for race, but every society constructs how they define racial categories. And so critical race theory in the U.S. looks at how race has been defined and employed in the United States.
By the way, if you have a question,
does it help any?
It does help, but what it also shows is that this is, I use the word nuanced. Now, I have to admit that we borrowed the word nuanced because that often comes up when trying to define critical race theory, nuanced and complicated, that it is not easily explained, so it seems as though many people have kind of constructed their own definitions. Would you agree of that? To that?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And that's part of the problem, right? When it enters the realm of politics, whether you're coming at it from, you know, the left side, the political spectrum, or the right side, we know that often what resonates politically are things that are not nuanced. It's trying to simplify things, and simplification can be good. We should be able to explain things simply and clearly, but oversimplification is a problem. And when I see what is defined as critical race theory, like in some of the bills that is in the one that was proposed in Pennsylvania in May and some other states, the ways in which they identify and define critical race theory is it really gross oversimplification? And some of it, frankly, is just wrong. Like, so a lot of what I read, I've been interacting with critical race theory. I would not call myself a critical race theorist, but I've been interacting with it for 25 years at least. And what I read is a lot of it's unrecognizable to me. Like, I don't know any critical race theory people who say some of the things that are in some of those bills.
Well, for example, what don't you recognize?
Okay, so for instance, the PA bill, which I had it up on my screen here and I seem to have lost it. says that, and it's also, it's, and by the way, the language in the PA bill is identical to language in Oklahoma and West Virginia, Tennessee, and several other states, because it's all coming from one source. And so that's part of the problem. You lose nuance. You're all going to depend on one source. And if that one source doesn't get it right, but the, some of the things where it says that any teaching or theory that says that all white people are racist, you can probably find some critical race theorist or scholar who uses critical race theory who has said that, just like you can find anybody in any a body of thinking or any political position who are on the extreme. But I don't know anybody who says all white people are racist, or that all white people should feel guilty. Or some of the language says that critical race theory teaches that if you're a particular race, you should feel guilty or feel bad about your race. And I, again, that's not critical race theory.
By the way, if you have a question or comment speaking to our audience, and you'd like to contribute to the program or weigh in on our conversation, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Hancock, when you say it's coming from one source, what is that one source? Who is that one source?
Well, one of their, I can't remember his first name. Chris Rufo is one. He's certainly not the one who started the movement, but he has perhaps gotten the most traction over the last year. And I don't know if he's the one who's created that language, but a lot of what he has argued and others have put together a document or documents from the Heritage Foundation and the American Legislative Exchange Council. They provide kind of model legislation, and they've done this in other avenues before in the past too. What I see is some of the statements and language that they use being replicated, often verbatim, in these different state legislatures.
Let's take a phone call from Lisa in Phoenixville. Lisa, you're on the air. Oh, I don't think Lisa, they're ready to go. At least we'll get to Lisa in just a moment. But, you mentioned some of those other states like Tennessee, for example, that is one of the Tennessee, Idaho, Oklahoma states that have their legislatures have already banned the teaching of critical race theory. And should have mentioned very early on that the real controversy right now is whether this should be taught in schools or not. I want to read, this is a quote from a teacher in Tennessee, an English teacher, Mike Stein, told Chalkbeat Tennessee. Now, this is something to do, he's pointing to unintended consequences of banning critical race theory, and the state's definition of critical race theory is that history teachers cannot adequately teach about the Trail of Tears, the Civil War, and the Civil Rights Movement. English teachers will have to avoid teaching almost any text by an African-American author because many of them mention racism to various extents. What this teacher is saying is that because of those bans, that things that have been taught for years in history classes, in English classes, other classes, that they have to stay away from. And that in this article I read, that the teachers have had to go beyond their thinking, they're second-guessing themselves all the time about what they can teach, what they can't teach, and the reaction to it. Have you seen that as well?
Well, I've been reading it and following it in the news, these kinds of things, and reading different high school teachers who have said very much the same thing. And even there was an article, I think, in the New York Times today by four people who are across the political spectrum who make a very similar argument that really that in many respects, these bills are contrary or the antithesis to what a liberal, and I don't mean liberal like conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, but a liberal education. By liberal, I mean classic kind of liberalism, that it's supposed to be about freedom and liberty, like First Amendment, would be a classic example of liberalism, and that these bills are suppressing that. And you know, ironically, I think the if we want our country to be better, and this is part of what critical race theory actually, when it's founded, what was the goal was to make the country better, then we need to be able to identify the problems and how those problems are created. And it's, there are certainly aspects of critical race theory that are fair to criticize. And one of the things I'd like to point out is that critical race theorists disagree about a lot amongst themselves. It's been around for over 40 years, and it hasn't been a secret. It's not like it's been hiding anywhere. So there's plenty of debate among critical race theorists. But one thing that there would, I think, be broad consensus on is kind of what that teacher is saying, that we need to teach all of this stuff. And part of the reason that critical race theory came into being, one of the many reasons, is when they looked at education processes in the United States, they found that most of the textbooks in the United States, in high school, for instance, said very little about these things. You know, it was a very triumphal kind of history. And there's nothing wrong with some aspects of triumphal history, but that dominated by far. So I think what that teacher is pointing to, I think, is spot on. We need an education that wrestles with the ugly stuff as well as points to, you know, the significant achievements.
Let's take that call now from Lisa in Phoenixville. Lisa, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. How are you both?
Doing well.
This is a great conversation. Thank you. I just wanted to point out, I have my own theory on why this hysteria is being created around critical race theory. I'm a former school board president, and in our elementary schools, to my knowledge, in Pennsylvania, it's not being taught. So this bill to ban it is just absurd. But this constant attack on public education, the constant undermining in confidence, if you look at it in conjunction with pushing voucher bills and other defunding mechanisms for public schools, it's really an effort to, what I say is, you know, it's to launder our public funds into private profit. Because they can't touch local property taxes. They go directly to local public schools. But if you undermine confidence, if you create mass hysteria, as they're doing with this nonsense, and when I say they, I mean the people who are pushing these bills and pushing this disinformation, you know, it's a much bigger problem that we're having. Because what they're doing now is confusing critical race theory and equity. So equity policy is what we're talking about in elementary public schools. And that's a whole bigger conversation I'd love to have. But I'd love to hear what, you know, your guest thinks on why this is happening.
All right, Lisa, thank you very much for your call. Actually, I have to say, Dr. Hancock, I've received several emails and calls kind of along the same lines, that there's more to this than just addressing race.
Yeah, well, I think definitely. And referring to what Lisa said, I mean, because I'm not in, you know, I don't work, well, I coach at a high school. Beyond that, I don't work in, you know, public schools, high schools or elementary schools. So I don't want to go beyond what I know. But what she says to me makes sense. I think there's probably, I don't want to sound too much like conspiracy theory thinking. I think there is more going on here. Part of it is, it seems to me that it's a lot about protecting power, political power, that there's people who know it will resonate with a certain constituency. And so if you oversimplify things and just keep hitting on those points, you're going to generate a broad base of support. Having said that, though, I don't want to discount or make it sound like some people who have concerns about critical race theory and its influences, because I would agree with Lisa, it's not being taught that I'm aware of in any public school or even private schools at the K through 12 level. But one could certainly argue, well, perhaps one could certainly ask the question, are there influences from critical race theory that have shaped the way that some teachers in public schools think, or and that you know, in an indirect way filters down into some of their education. So for instance, if you have a high school teacher teaching that systemic racism is something that we need to deal with, one could say, well, but that's a critical race theory. you don't have to be a critical race theorist to understand systemic racism. You could reject most of critical race theory and still accept systemic racism, which, like I said, man, there's just mountains of evidence for it. And one of the things I would kind of challenge respectfully those who are criticizing critical race theory is if we can actually have a reasonable conversation, not the like Lisa said, the hysteria that I think is evident in some of the legislation, but if we could have a reasonable conversation, I would say, okay, present to me the evidence that systemic racism isn't legit. And I think it would be really difficult to do, to counter the evidence that historians and sociologists and political scientists and other people have mounted that systemic racism is something that is difficult to deal with and is a real thing that we need to wrestle with if we want our country to be better.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Dr. Scott Hancock. He's a professor of history and Africana studies at Gettysburg College. We're talking about critical race theory, some of the myths, some of the misunderstandings, some of the things we need to understand. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Hancock, you just said that you're not aware of critical race theory being taught in schools. We had a question from a listener who said, if it is so nuanced, then why would it be taught to anyone under the age of 16?
Yeah, well. First, I'd say I think we need to be teaching nuanced things to high schoolers, but I think that listener makes a good point, and which is why generally I think you'll see it more in the at the college level. For instance, I use critical race theory in what I teach here, but when I teach it, one of the courses I teach is Introduction to African-American Studies. So if you're going to be in African-American Studies, you need to know what critical race theory is. When I teach it, I don't teach it as to students as you need to accept this whole cloth, or you know you can't critique it or act with it. But it's rather presenting to them, if you're going to be in this field, if you're going to do anything in this field, then you should know what this is because it's an important theory, just like you would in any other academic discipline. You would want to know some of the basic thinking, but you know there are perhaps ways for a 16 or 17 year old, I think, can grasp things like systemic racism. There are some basic ways you could teach intersectionality, which is another word that I hear a lot of people saying, well, it's identity politics and things like that. And perhaps there's some truth in that. But can I give you a good example? I like examples.
Yeah, sure. I was going to ask you for an example. Go ahead.
Okay. So intersectionality, and I'm taking this example from one of the primers and kind of introduction to critical race theory. Intersectionality, people often get really worked up about. It's the scholars, the lawyers, and historians and sociologists who kind of started thinking about all this stuff back in the 70s, and it kind of coalesces into a body of thinking in the late 1980s. One of the things they looked at is out of the civil rights movement, you have anti-discrimination laws. Okay, that's great. But they critical race theorists would also argue that if you are trying to achieve change simply by changing laws, it's going to be very slow and incremental, and it's going to miss a lot. So one of the things that miss in anti-discrimination laws is if you're a Black woman or Latina or, you know, whatever racial category it might be. But so for I'm going to use a Black woman as an example. If you're a Black woman and you are working as an assistant manager in a store or business, and your immediate boss keeps promoting other people and you keep getting passed over year after year. And so you begin to think that there's something going on here. So you could file for many years, and as far as I know, this is still the case, but legal scholars would be best to ask on this. You could file a lawsuit for racial discrimination. So let's say your manager can say, hey, I've promoted Black people, but it's all men. So that woman loses because she can't show that there's a pattern of racial discrimination. So she decides to sue on gender discrimination. Well, the boss can show that he has promoted women. They all happen to be white women. So she again loses. So intersectionality was a way to recognize that there are some people for whom the law doesn't recognize they have these intersections of identity, that sometimes people have no problem with black men or with white women, but they got a problem with black women. So this is just, I think, one example where critical race theory is actually really helpful in helping us understand how some people are not treated equally and there is not equity for them.
Let's take some phone calls. Les is in Harrisburg. Les, you're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
You know, I've always been a fan of just teaching the truth. You know, just if it happened, it happened. And, you know, it just seems so simple to just teach the truth, make sure it's facts. My only restriction on teaching would be to make sure that facts are presented as facts and opinions are presented as opinions to the students or the listener. Mm-hmm. And that's all I got to say. Thank you.
All right, Les, thank you very much for your call. Let's kind of simplifies it, tries to make it crystal clear, but it isn't exactly that clear because sometimes, especially today, facts are often, opinions are often presented as facts. Would you agree with that?
Yes, and that's actually, like at the college level, that's what we want to teach students not to do. For instance, I tell students all the time that if they're going to write an essay for me that has their opinion and it's not based on any evidence, that essay is not going to get a good grade. Doesn't matter if I agree with them or not. We want them to root it in evidence. But there's actually, so what his name was Les, the listener said was, I agree, but where it gets difficult, and I think what you're getting at, Scott, is, well, we can choose which facts do we teach, right? We can't teach all the facts. There's not a class long enough or a school long enough to teach all the facts. So you have to choose which facts. And this is where some of the people who are concerned about critical race theory, I think we should listen to them because I think some of their concern is, well, they perceive that some of the facts that have been taught or been chosen are just the negative ones. I don't think that's true. But I'm sure there are instances where that's true, but I don't think that overall is true. One of the problems with a lot of the legislation that's being mounted is I don't think most of the people writing that legislation have been public school teachers. There's probably a few, but I don't think most of them have been or have written curriculum. I think those are the people we need to be listening to. But this is something that I wrestle with. I want to make sure when I teach, for instance, African-American history, that I'm not teaching a triumphal history, but nor is it just a funeral march through the miserable parts of American history. And it's always a challenge, but I think most teachers, K through 12 and college, wrestle honestly with that kind of challenge. And ultimately, I think, Scott, it comes down to what do we want our children to learn? I the bills that I see in the state legislature seem to me to be driven by fear, by getting people to be afraid of things. I think what most people in the field of critical race theory, or people like me, I wouldn't call myself a critical race theorist, but I would say certainly I use a lot of it, have been influenced by it. I think we've got facts on our side. So I would ask, what do you want your children to learn fear, or do you want them to learn facts?
Couple things here. We got an email from a listener, which I thought was a good way, nice heading, nice outline for how to understand this a little bit better. Pointed out to me, it was a YouTube presentation of critical race theory. Four different parts: study of law, impact over intent, unintended consequences, and indivisibility of racism. What does all that mean, and how does do those four headings relate to critical race theory?
Okay, so, and what was the last one? Indivisibility of racism?
Right, yes.
So that one I'm not as familiar with. So I might have to guess what that means. But, and I'm sorry, I focused too much on that one. What were the first three again, real quick?
Study of law, impact over intent, and unintended consequences.
Okay, yeah. So study of law, and I think that's because, like the example I gave, critical race theory really is born out of the legal field by analyzing the the ways in which civil rights movement and legislation fell short. Impact over intent. So the intent may be good of much legislation or other movements, but what critical race theorists are concerned with or want to focus on is, so what's the actual impact? Now, how does it play out in society? So for instance, another quick example, I'll try to be concise, is redlining, where the federal government and real estate agencies and banks and businesses designated certain parts of cities as undesirable. And those were, and part of what made them undesirable is because they had black and brown people in them. Redlining largely ends in the late 1960s, early 70s. And so you have these new laws that are supposedly going to make housing more available to people across the racial and ethnic spectrum. But what the impact of those laws actually did was it made Kianga Yamada Taylor calls predatory inclusion, where you have real estate agencies and banks who are now preying on poor black people by selling them houses that are poorly maintained in poor neighborhoods where the value won't increase because they're backed by the federal housing authority. So if they fail on those mortgages, those lending institutions get all of the money anyway. And so the residential segregation we see today and the fact that black homes are valued at about anywhere from $46,000 to $56,000 less than white homes in similar neighborhoods, a lot of that is the result of the impact of laws that on their face seemed really good. And I'm sorry, what was the third one again?
And it sounded kind of goes into just what you described, unintended consequences.
Yeah, that would be, I'll stop there because it'd be very similar. Because the intent is often really good, but we want to think, well, okay, intent matters, but we want to see how does it actually play out.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Pam in Harrisburg. Pam, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much. One of the things, like you were saying, the fear which the I hate to say it, the Republicans and all these people pushing these bills really means money, because if they instill the fear, they're going to get more money. Also, the talking heads, which push this stuff no end, get money in the way of more and more ratings. Thank you very much for this great discussion. Really
all right.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Pam. And before Dr. Hancock responds to that, I want to go to our next caller, Ben, because he has a comment along the same lines. Ben is in Lancaster. Go ahead, Ben.
Morning. Just wanted to say that I think Christopher Rufo, the gentleman that Professor Hancock mentioned, has said publicly that what his political goal here is for people to read some crazy anecdote from a corporate diversity training or something to think critical race theory and then to mobilize politically against that, such that the conversation we're having this morning, while informative, is not entirely on the terms that, you know, they're not using the same terms in terms of understanding what critical race theory actually is, that it's an empty signifier for something else that can sound scary to the point of the last caller and mobilize political support. Thanks.
Ben, thank you very much for your call. And I'm going to add one more thing, a headline in today's Washington Post, that, and it was an opinion piece, said that critical race theory is the new Trump, that those who are simplified in misrepresenting it, that this is their way of, that they no longer have a president in the White House, but this is their new way of saying Trump, Trump, Trump. Professor Hancock, what do you think?
I don't want to commit the same mistake of oversimplifying things. I think there's certainly a great deal of truth to that and the role of money, as a caller said, and I think he's right that in many ways what Rufo is doing is making CRT an empty signifier. So what I keep trying to do is I want to engage what I call analytical empathy, where I don't have to agree with people that disagree with me, but see it from their point of view. So there are certainly, I would argue that Rufo does exactly what the caller said, right? He finds some anecdotes and that are taken without context, and those sound terrible. But so there are a couple of ways we can react. We can dismiss that and say, oh, well, that doesn't characterize all the critical race theory, which it doesn't, and then not deal with it. Or we can think about, okay, so the people who are conveying those anecdotes, if their experience was real, or somebody had a teacher who said something that they felt like, you know, seemed like it was making their white child feel guilty just for being white, then we can also think about, okay, so what in that do we need to honestly deal with and wrestle with? Because like I said, critical race theory is constantly analyzing, critiquing itself. And so this is part of the process. That said, like Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the kind of the founding thinkers of critical race theory, has said recently, and I think history bears this out, that anytime we see subordinate groups in a society, in American society, so Black people, Latinas, women, queer people, whoever it may be, anytime we see those groups making significant inroads, there are some groups, not all white people, not all people in the majority, but there are some who see it as a zero-sum game. Like, if those people gain, then are we going to lose? And so there's a retrenchment. We get a retrenchment after emancipation with Jim Crow. We get a retrenchment after World War I when Black soldiers come back and you see the rise of the KKK and things like Tulsa and Rosewood in Florida. You get a retrenchment after the Civil Rights Movement in the 1970s and 80s with mass incarceration. I think in many ways what we're seeing now is a similar trend. And critical race theory is the latest way to kind of retrench or protect people who feel that somehow it's a zero-sum game.
Okay. You know, we've touched on this several times during our conversation, but I want to bring this out because, I mean, it is something that simplifies what what critical race theory is, according to your definition. But there are many people who believe this. This is a recent poll by the advocacy group Parents Defending Education. They claim that some schools are teaching that white people are inherently privileged, while Black and other people of color are inherently oppressed and victimized, that achieving racial justice and equality between racial groups requires discriminating against people based on their whiteness, and that the United States was founded on racism. Is that accurate under any of that accurate under critical race theory?
I would say no. And again, you can probably find some critical race theorists on one end of the spectrum who would say that, yeah, a lot of that's true. But as a whole, I would say that is a distortion, a gross distortion of what it's about. Certainly, and this is where some of your listeners will probably find objectionable. Certainly, critical race theory would argue that race and racism is integral to the founding of the United States, but so is ideals of freedom and liberty. And that's the great thing about teaching American history, is we can wrestle with that tension. People who want to say that race and racism had nothing to do with the American founding, I would say you're ignoring mountains of historical evidence.
See, I think that this is probably what that tension is, what a lot of people wrestle with. And I'm going to give it, an example. George Washington just finished a book on Valley Forge that made me realize that George Washington, there may not been a big United States of America without George Washington at Valley Forge and how he held the army together. Just gave me more respect for George Washington. But today, we often hear, right after we hear about George Washington as the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, first president of the United States, what a great American he was. Oh, but he was a slave owner and bought and traded slaves. There are a lot of Americans who don't want to hear that part of the history.
Yeah, and I think if you don't want to hear that history, you don't want the country to be better. My one qualification, Scott, I wouldn't say George Washington was a... I would agree with the ways in which you described him is he's critical to the founding of America, right? There's much to admire about George Washington, an incredible amount to admire about George Washington. I wouldn't say, but he was a slave. I would say, yeah, there's an incredible amount to admire. And he was a slave owner who understood that when he brought his slaves into Pennsylvania, if they were here for more than 6 months, they would be free by Pennsylvania law. So he took them back to Virginia in order to make sure they weren't free. And when one of his slaves, like Ona Judge, ran away, he and then Martha Washington pursued her for years. So he wasn't just a slave owner, a reluctant slave owner. He was a very engaged slave owner who profited immensely from slave owning, but at the same time had these ideals about freedom and liberty and respected the rule of law in ways that I wish more of our, some of our political leaders would today. When you said there wouldn't be an America without George Washington, I mean, you know, the historian in me thinks, ah, that might be a bit of a hyperbole.
Oh, yeah, I think it was.
It's not a completely inaccurate statement to make.
Yeah.
But let's deal with both, you know.
Yeah, the point I was making is that there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable because I think it was something you referred to earlier that we were talking about that triumphant history that so many Americans have learned that triumphant history about George Washington and are uncomfortable with hearing the other but.
Yeah, and I guess I'm not afraid of that. You know, mm-hmm. I'm not afraid of the noble and honorable and admirable stuff in American history about individuals. And I'm not afraid of the evil, sinful, corrupt, you know, ugly stuff about Americans and American history. It's the human condition, mm-hmm. you know, so, you know, if I would, there's an article in the Denver Post a few months ago that defined patriotism. And it said a patriot is someone who's willing to criticize in order to make the country better. Someone who is willing to suppress the truth is not a patriot. So I'd say let's be patriotic and let's deal with all of it. Like I said, the people who if they perceive that academics like me or people who are influenced by critical race theory are only focusing on the negative, that's a critique that we should listen to. That we have to consider. I don't think that is what most of us do. But as I said earlier, it's certainly something that we always need to be wrestling with.
And I have to clarify, was kind of being hyperbolic with the Washington thing. I mean, eventually there would have been a United States of America. But great conversation. Dr. Hancock, always enjoy talking with you. Dr. Scott Hancock is a professor of history and Africana studies at Gettysburg College. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Older Americans are at a greater risk of falling with age. That's no surprise to a lot of people, due in large part to changes in physical strength, mobility, and balance. But falls can be deadly, particularly because of the dangers of head injuries. The pandemic has increased the risk to seniors because of isolation and a lot of other reasons. Joining us to talk about this rash of falls amongst older Americans, Dr. Roland Wright and Dr. Aisha Ahmad, both geriatric medicine department and internal medicine at Penn State Health. Dr. Wright and Ahmad, welcome to the program. Let me start with you, Dr. Wright. Data released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last month. The rate of fall-related deaths among Pennsylvanians over the age of 65 reached near highs in 2020. It was an estimated 76% or 76 fatalities per 100,000 people between July and September. That was a 9% jump from the previous year. Why do you think the number of deaths are up?
Probably because a fall is truly a sentinel event, especially in older people. As older people are more shut in, they become more sedentary. Sedentariness leads to significant deconditioning. And this sort of deconditioning sets into motion loss of muscle mass, loss of bone tissue. And again, sedentariness leads to increased risk of falling. The falls that we see here at Penn State Medical Center, you know, we see just about all older fallers who come into onto the trauma service. They're there because they've had a significant injury, like fracture, or like you said, a head injury, head bleed. And once somebody has that fracture, it's a life-changing event. Recovery from a fracture, especially a hip fracture, is pretty dicey. You never get back to where you were. And the recovery process in place during the pandemic has been such that the kind of rehab that we're giving older people is far less quality than they were getting before the pandemic, because in these rehab settings, they just don't have the exercise programs in these communal group rooms where all the exercise equipment is. So they're not getting as good rehab either.
Hmm. You know, something you said about hip fractures. I've always wondered about that. What is it when someone fractures a hip that you said that their life is just never the same? Why are hip fractures so significant?
Again, it's kind of like it is that sentinel event. It's that shot across the bow that something structurally is wrong. The hip fracture is the hip is really the load bearing part of the body. And if that part of the body is crumbly bumbly, again, with poor bone integrity, poor muscle integrity, it's not like you can put it back together fully the way it was before. So hip fractures, and the data repeatedly bear this out, result in one of three consequences. You know, 25% end up dying sometime within a year of the hip fracture because of the cascade of events that the hip fracture sets into motion. 25% end up in a higher level of care, like going from home to a personal care or personal care to nursing home, because they're just not able to take care of themselves. They don't have the same ambulatory integrity. And then 50% end up walking, but not as well as they did before. So a hip fracture inalterably changes the integrity of, again, the load-bearing part of the body. You can't put it back together perfectly. Mm.
Dr. Mod, want to follow up, though, that first question I had with Dr. Wright, is that the number of fatal falls has increased. Is that just because there are more people falling during the pandemic because of some of the reasons that Dr. Wright mentioned? Or is there something, maybe it's because the population is getting older? Just what? Why more fatal falls?
I think the answer is probably nuanced, because even pre-pandemic, half of the people who fall are unable to get up without help. So they end up with what we call in geriatrics, the long lie syndrome. They stay on the ground for hours and sometimes days until a friend, a family member comes and picks them up. And they obviously present with, you know, really terrible sequelae from that fall. I think what the pandemic has done is people have neglected some of their chronic and acute medical issues because of social isolation, because of fear, especially in the beginning. So I think some of their medical conditions have brewed to the point where they became a crisis, and that could have contributed. In addition, the social isolation has played a huge role in people who fell and couldn't get up, couldn't get help, and probably lay on the ground. The longer you lie, the worse are the outcomes, ranging from muscle injury that could actually end up being toxic for your kidneys to, you know, strange things like critical illness, neuropathy. So the longer you keep laying on the floor, which unfortunately for our population could be days sometimes, the worst are the outcomes.
Well, that
and I would add to that a lot during the pandemic, older folks were isolated from their families, and families are big time helpers in getting them through daily activities. And so the family member who might have come to do mom's laundry isn't able to do that. So then mom is getting the laundry up and down the basement steps.
Hmm. You know, your description of, you know, someone on the floor for hours, days. I mean, that's just a frightening thing that no one wants to go through, number one, or actually see someone that has happened to. You know, this maybe seem like a simple, not a solution, but just a question. I've heard some older people ask, well, should I get one of those alert bracelets? What do the two of you think about that? Dr. Wright, let me start with you.
I absolutely think that having a life alert bracelet is hugely important, especially if older people are still alone a lot of the time. There isn't a helper there to get them up off the floor, and so they will just lie there. So yeah, the bracelet plugs right on into 911, and then somebody can help that person get off the floor. So it's either a pendant or a bracelet. Could be a game changer.
Dr. Ahmad, one of the questions that I'm sure a lot of people would have is how to prevent people from falling. I mean, this has happened as people have gotten older forever. Now, granted, we're pointing out that there are more people falling during the pandemic for some unique reasons. But what can medical science do to prevent people from falling?
So because falls themselves are a complex geriatric syndrome that often have more than one cause, the prevention often also lies in, you know, modifying a number of things. So we as geriatricians would advise, you know, a multi-pronged approach. For example, discontinuing or minimizing medications that cause sedation, modifying the home environment, making sure it's well lighted, making sure you don't have rugs or other things that could cause mechanical falls, making sure that your blood pressures are neither too high nor too low, because sometimes a low blood pressure can contribute to falls, making sure your patient is wearing adequate footwear, which, you know, can play a very big role sometimes. And then prescribing exercise, not just for strengthening muscles, but also for balance and gait training. So, you know, we're big proponents of things like Tai Chi or you know, a sequence of exercises that doesn't just work on muscle strengthening, but also balance. There are certain cases where we supplement vitamin D. A lot of older adults have poor vision, so sometimes that gets neglected. So, you know, there are a number of things that can be done. So the most important thing is your older adult needs to be screened for falls at their doctor's appointment. And if the screening is positive, then the physician sort of, you know, opens up a series of questions and can hopefully tackle this problem with a multi-pronged approach.
So what the word prevention is key there, right?
It is. As Dr. Wright said, a fall is a sentinel event, and sometimes one single fall can really change your life trajectory. So it's very important to prevent that fall. And unfortunately, you know, if you start with a fall, it becomes a huge risk of subsequent falling because of what Dr. Wright described. You develop this fear of falling, so you self-limit your mobility, and that leads to the cascade of more muscle loss. So it just sets up a vicious cycle.
I want to thank both of you for being with us today, and hopefully it gets a lot of people thinking about ways what they can do to prevent falls and to keep themselves and their family members safe from falling. Dr. Roland Wright and Dr. Aisha Ahmad in the Geriatric Medicine Department, Internal Medicine at Penn State Health. Thank both of you for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.
For a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross.